What is up, everybody? Oh!
Oh, it's the story Joker's here!
Oh my god. I'm leaving.
There's a couple of wise guys.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to the Fat... I forgot we changed it. We changed the flow. Man, I got 330 episodes of Habit
you
to
break. You can do it that way, and then
you
just...
literally wrote the new intro.
I rewrote it for a reason. It is optimal. I've optimized the script, Kathy. And...
what he's saying, Kathy, is he spent 330 episodes doing it badly.
No, no, doing it pre-improvement.
So worse.
Suboptimal would be the better way to say it. No, based on the new intro, it had to be reworked. The old one was perfect. Okay. Welcome to episode 335 of The Fascinating Podcast, a show about the fascinating people and events at the heart of our cultural conversations. I'm Clay Morgan.
I'm J.R. Forresteros.
And I'm Kathy Kong.
Mr. Michalotis is muy mal and unable to join us today as we talk about the 1976 Women's Olympic basketball team with author Andrew Marinus. But first...
a very important question. If you found a trail of slime, would you follow it?
Yes.
Yeah.
You would. Both of you would. I'm surprised by this.
Well, because it probably, I mean, in my mind, it involves a family member leaving a mess.
Oh, you were talking about indoors. I was thinking more like
indoors
out
or outdoors. Yeah.
A trail, a trail is a very different prompt than, say, a puddle. Puddle of slime, avoid. Trail.
Would you follow a puddle of slime? No.
No, because the puddle is self-contained and evident.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
you have to follow a trail.
In Berlin recently, German custom officials followed a trail of slime, and guess what they found?
Snails?
Snails!
Cargo.
Almost 100 giant African land snails and some other meat items.
Wait. Some other meat? So these snails were not independent and on the move.
They were in a bag, but I don't know who put a hole in the bag, whether it was the snails or some sort of shipping accident.
To
but
breathe.
One of the snails escaped, hence the trail of slime.
Oh.
The baggage handlers they thought it was a fake snail until it moved. They realized it was a real snail, so they followed the slime back to the bag and the hole where another snail was preparing to make its escape.
Yes!
Who thinks?
Yes.
Preparing to make his escape because it's only been 7 hours.
Right, correct. Yeah.
What is this assumption that the first one was fake? It's not a real snail.
Well, yeah, just because they're giant and slimy, and it looked when they don't move, they're like, oh, someone put like a gag snail. You know the gag giant. Snails.
I don't
gag
know why snails. I'm so excited
huge
about
in Berlin.
This, but I love it. I love it. Go snails. Go snails.
Germans are wacky for African giant snails. Were you to
they
hold
were to
this
eat,
in,
yes?
Were you to hold this
were
in
they?
Your hand, it would uh-huh. it would go from the back of your palm to the tip of your middle finger.
Oh, so maybe not to eat? Are they just like for pets? I don't what
oh,
does
no, they
one do
eat.
With a snail?
This,
okay.
They were able to determine that this was being smuggled to a being smuggled to a food store in Berlin.
Oh yes. Yeah, butter
Another
and garlic.
Animal smuggle. I mean it's
so
gotta be sad. To have the heart of a cheetah and the body of a snail.
A snail, yeah. So they were unable to make their escape, and I'm actually not sure what... This is my favorite. This is...
we don't know how many got away before that first one was discovered.
Well, there's only one slime trail, so...
Some snails are better
camouflaged.
One that
was discovered. That's all.
I'm going to go ahead and quote from the spokesperson for the Dusseldorf Customs. Never in the history of Dusseldorf Customs Office has a trail of slime led us to smuggled goods.
That is amazing.
I like to believe that somewhere out there is just like this one lone snail that got away, just like smoking a cigarette and saying, my friends didn't make it.
It was a snail holocaust.
That's smoked snail. Anyway, so Clay, JR, who's going to tell us about our guest?
I am going to.
Okay.
Yes, he is a New York Times best-selling author named Andrew Marinus, as Clay said. He writes sports and history-related nonfiction, telling stories with a larger social message. So his first book, which is called Strong Inside, received the Lillian Smith Book Award for Civil Rights and the RFK Book Award Special Recognition Prize for Social Justice, which is actually the first sports-related book ever to win either one of those awards. And so his young readers adaptation of Strong Inside was named one of the top biographies for youth by the American Library Association and was a notable studies book by the Children's Book Council. He's written several other books. He's won a ton of awards. He lives in Nashville, as he's going to mention, and he is the special projects director for the Vanderbilt University Athletics Department. His new book is called Inaugural Ballers, and it is the true story of the very first women's Olympic basketball team for the United States. So it ends up being about women's rights, about queer rights, about minority rights, and, you know, also basketball. It's got U.S. history. It's got sports. It's pretty much got everything you could want. And it's actually like a YA book. So it's a fun interview. Andrew is great. We could have kept him on for probably another hour and a half just talking about all kinds of stuff. But we really hope you enjoy our interview with Andrew. Andrew Marinus, welcome to the Fascinating Podcast. It's such an honor to have you on.
Yeah, it's an honor to be with you all. Thank you for the invitation.
So we always like to ask our first-time guests, what is something in life that fascinates you?
Oh, wow. Great question. I would say kids right now fascinate me. I have a daughter who just turned 12, a son who just turned 9, and like a lot of families, I think, you wonder, did these two kids grow up under the same roof, like with the same parents, you know, because they're completely different in a lot of ways, wonderful in their own ways. But just the psychology of kids, behavior of kids fascinates me. And I would add to that, not to, you know, purely compare kids to dogs, but dogs also fascinate me right now as well. There's a lot of similarities you have to
completely
admit.
Unrelated.
Did you hear that, listeners?
I mean, let's not pretend like he's wrong.
Yeah, come on.
Okay, that's why we did not get a dog. My kids wanted a dog, and I was like, if I wanted another child, I would have had another child.
We underestimated that when we got this puppy from a shelter and he came in our house. And my wife and I both had dogs growing up as kids. We hadn't had one as adults, and it shocked us how much it, like a newborn it was. We weren't sure if we could handle it. Thought we that stage.
Yep.
That's
nope.
A lot. You so, Andrew, coming up as I did as a history guy in the 90s, I came across your dad's work plenty of times. I had to, each person in one class had to take a president, and I landed on Clinton.
Okay.
So I actually had much fresher source material than some of my fellow students.
That's right.
Given that it had just come out in the mid-90s. But for folks who don't know, your dad's obviously a very accomplished writer. And now you've obviously taken that up and written, what is this, your fourth or fifth book?
Yeah, it's my fourth book.
Fourth book?
Yeah.
So now, as you watch the 9 and 12-year-old, do you see the writer life blooming in one of them or no?
Yeah, hopefully they're smart enough not to do it. You know?
Yes.
I think they are. My father was a journalist as I was growing up. He hadn't written any books yet until after I got out of college. And his dad, my grandfather, was a newspaper editor. My grandmother on that side was an editor at the University of Wisconsin Press also. So like writing was a big part of that side of the family. My mom actually wrote a book too for kids on respecting the environment, the Gulf of Mexico. So writing has been a big part of my life. The people that would come to our house when I was growing up were journalist, you know, at the Washington Post. I would tag along with my dad to press conferences, you know, when I was a kid, or up to the newsroom, and I would sneak over to the sports department. And this is in the way before digital days, you know, so there were file cabinets full of pictures of every sports team that they might run in the paper as a file photo. Me being a Milwaukee Brewers fan, like, I stole every picture the Washington Post had in their Milwaukee Brewers folder. So hopefully they never needed any.
Why are there no photos in this folder?
Exactly. It was a big part of my life growing up. My kids are now at the age where they can start to read my books for the first time. And my books are, to a large part, considered young adult books, although I hope that adults find them written for them too. But my 12-year-old daughter just started reading my first book, Strong Inside. And I asked her, like, well, what do you think? You know, hoping, like, for this, like, the best review that I had ever gotten, just enthusiasm, a big hug. And she, like, didn't say anything for, like, 15 seconds. I don't know. I need to win over my own family. But no, she said she liked it eventually.
Well, you know, yeah, she lives eventually with you. So,
yeah, so I mean, that's probably your toughest audience.
Yeah, no, without a doubt.
So as we're talking about writing and books and children, why this book? And why the Olympic team from 1976? Mm-hmm. What is so compelling about this? Why do you think young readers need to know about this team?
Yeah. Well, you know, as Clay was mentioning, like, this isn't my first book. So what I try to do with my books is to write about sports and history and social issues. My first book, Strong Inside, was about the first Black basketball player in the SEC. So it was about racism and the civil rights era in the South in the 1960s and the toll of pioneering. My second book is called Games of Deception. It's the story of the first U.S. men's Olympic basketball team at the 1936 Olympics in Nazi Germany. So that's the book that uses sports to talk about fascism and anti-Semitism. My third book is called Singled Out. It's a biography of Glenn Burke, who was the first openly gay Major League Baseball player. And so that book's using baseball to talk about homophobia. And then with this book, I wanted to use sports and women's athletics in particular to talk about women's rights movement in the 1970s. You know, this is the 50th anniversary of Title IX this year also. So there's been a lot of attention on the growth of women's sports over those last 50 years and the progress that still needs to be made. And one of the areas of inequity, I think, as an author, is that there aren't as many books about women's sports either, you know, and particularly for young readers. And, you know, I just have so much confidence in this younger generation that is active and involved and cares about these social issues that I thought this would be a story that would be of interest to them and that I would love to research and to write.
So you open with early stories of women playing basketball. And I was just so fascinated by the fact that a lot of them didn't even know the basic rules. They just, you know, just wanted to play. They just wanted to go out there and they, you know, play it in their period appropriate outfits, appropriate, not to the basketball court.
And their frocks.
Frocks and all that, you know. And, you know, we've seen this, I think, again and again, the new League of Their Own show that just came out, which is bringing a whole new generation to that story of women's baseball in the 40s, women's National Football League. We had one of the authors of that book, Hail Mary, on last season. Mm-hmm. To talk about that. And we see again and again and again this this real reticence by, I guess, you know, the men who tend to be in charge of everything to allow women to play in these spaces. I guess we should say it's not just men. You actually mentioned Lou Hoover, the first lady, who was also very vocally against these sorts of things, and at least women playing in front of mixed crowds.
Right.
What do you think is behind all of that? Like, as you've researched all of this, like, what do you see happening there?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, in writing about the 1976 Olympic team and them being the first women's Olympic basketball team, you know, it's important to say it wasn't because women had just started playing basketball, you know, or that women had just started becoming interested in participating in athletics in the 1970s. I mean, it's been forever, right? I write in the book that there were women playing basketball within a week or two of the sport's invention in Springfield, Massachusetts. But there's been hostility directed towards women interested in sports going back to antiquity, you know, in the ancient Olympics. You would be killed if you were a woman who participated or even showed up to watch the Olympics in those days. So this has been a part of athletics forever. In the days that these women who were coming along, who played on the 76 team as young girls, they were told, you know, you should not be competitive. You shouldn't build muscles. You shouldn't sweat. This is all unladylike, and you're going to make yourself unappealing to boys and to men, which is, you know, your highest ambition in life, right? I mean, all these obstacles they had to overcome, not just as athletes, but in society around them. And men were saying that women shouldn't play full court basketball, that they were going to damage their ovaries, that they might, if they got hit in the chest
too much,
with the ball.
Too much bouncing.
Yeah, right. Is that,
like, because they know all about ovaries.
Yeah, they know all about them. They know better than women, of course. Yeah, so, you know, if you get hit in the chest, you're going to get breast cancer. I mean, and sort of putting on this facade that it was to protect women, when really, in doing the research for this book, it became clear that it was about protecting men, you know, and protecting, keeping sports as their venue, you know, and protecting the money that was going into sports. Keep it for men. The, you know, selfish motivations behind keeping women out of their sphere, or a sphere that they wanted to keep to themselves.
So I appreciate, obviously, you have a love of history and sport, and you bring that to your writing. So when you have a chance to kind of set the context, you could introduce maybe some Cold War dynamics and how it was very important that Americans had a certain kind of image. And that, of course, fed into maybe those views of traditional womanhood, or maybe Billie Jean King, when you talk about the Battle of the Sexes, a more accessible event that a lot of people know about, if not before the movie, mm-hmm. that helps you then kind of set the stage for the 70s. So when you're telling those stories, what is it that was most exciting from the history part of your brain to dig into on this particular project?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with all my books, I think it's really important to set the sports angle into the social, historical, political context of the times in which these characters were existing, you know? And I think that's what can elevate a sports book into being more, you know, and that's what I want to do, is not just write about the scores of games or statistics of players, but really elevate the story. So for me, that was all about the women's rights movement, primarily in the 1970s, but also including earlier eras and going back to, you know, what they would call first wave feminism and women's suffrage, and the ways that popularity or the ability even to play sports sort of ebbed and flowed over the years. It was interesting to me that it wasn't just a solid progression towards more and more acceptance and participation, that there were eras in American history. Like, so 1920s, women are gaining the right to vote. That's also a time when women's athletics are popular and supported. And then, like you mentioned earlier, it was First Lady Hoover is leading a commission to ban men from watching women's basketball, or women even to be able to play, in the 1930s. Then in the 1940s, you've got Rosie Riveter building planes. How could you tell her she couldn't play basketball? You know, so women's athletics starts to reemerge. Then things become more conservative in the 1950s, and women's athletics take a back seat again. Then by the 70s, a fight for Equal Rights Amendment and Title IX, women's sports come back. So all of that was really interesting for me. I think the most interesting historical nugget for me to research in the book was going back to the 1904 Olympics, when you could say that basketball was actually played for the first time in the Olympics. It wasn't a medal sport. It was an exhibition of the game of basketball put on by Native American women from the Fort Shaw boarding school. You know, and we've heard the last few years about the horrors of these boarding schools and how the abuse that was taking place there. One of the things they were doing, whether it was Jim Thorpe at the Carlisle School in Pennsylvania or these women at Fort Shaw, is the leaders of these schools were using sports as a way to show how they were assimilating indigenous people into white culture. So having a basketball team was part of that. And so these girls came to St. Louis and, you know, were being used, but they also saw this as a chance to assert themselves, you know, and to do something excellently, and they dominated the exhibition of basketball at these Olympics in front of someone like Geronimo, who was there as a prisoner of the U.S. government, and the pride they had playing for someone they respected like Geronimo and beating the teams of white girls from St. Louis that were expected to beat them. That was a really interesting piece of history that I didn't know much about and was excited to research and to write about.
So you said something that really I want to kind of ask a little bit more about. You said that the Native women were being used, but then they also saw this as an opportunity to create a space for themselves and do something for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think, you mentioned again, a lot of the women in any women's sport, but in basketball as well, were accused of being queer or suspected to be queer in some way. Again, from, talking about, Hail Mary, the Women's National Football League, looking at the new A League of Their Own show, which is like super gay, for those who have seen it. And it's on purpose, right? And then my wife plays roller derby, which actually weirdly is one of the sports that, even though it has men's and women's, the men's is actually the afterthought.
Right.
Like the women's derby is the main one. Also a very, not just queer friendly, but queer space, it seems like the same thing, because all of those sports had this thing where they were started by men who were expecting to get like pinups in uniforms, to go out and, prance around and look cute.
Right.
In our frocks, again.
For the men, right? There's even those who have seen the new A League of Their Own show, there is a scene in the first episode where one of the owners is complaining that none of the women are pretty enough. That's not what they were expecting. In Hail Mary, they talked about how they had to. The owners chose to use models on the billboards instead of the actual players. And then, roller derby very much started out as like fishnets and skirts, and the penalty box was the sin bin and you got spanked and all. But like in all of these places, I feel like the same thing was going on. Like women saw that this was a space that was created to exploit them, but then they subverted that and took that and made it into a space where not only could they flourish as women, but again, a number of queer women in a time in America where it was very like illegal and dangerous to be queer had spaces where they could be at least more out than they could be anywhere else. I don't know. Like I'm trying to fumble around for a question here, but do you have any sense of, as you've done all of this research, about what it is about sports that facilitates that and why that's such a space that women consistently subvert away from male expectation?
Yeah, that's a really interesting dynamic. So I found several examples of male sports writers over the years criticizing women's athletics to the point that they were saying, it's a woman's job to look pretty, and you don't look pretty if you're out there competing, and running fast and sweating, and using that to denigrate some of the best women athletes of all time, like Babe Didrikson. They would say, shouldn't be out there, that's not her job, she should be home waiting by the phone for it to ring of a man asking her out on a date. Ann Myers, who was on the 76 Olympic team, told by her friends at school that she must be gay if she hadn't even had an interest in playing basketball. Nancy Lieberman talked about her mom and her grandmother. You mentioned the pressures weren't just coming from men. They were disappointed that she wasn't playing with dolls, wasn't wearing dresses. There was a popular barnstorming team in the 1950s and 60s called the All-American Redheads. That, like you say, they were made to dress up in somewhat provocative uniforms. They were acted kind of like the Harlem Globetrotters. There was a little bit of acting to their games, and there would be a foul called, and they would, because one of the male players on the other team like pinched their butt, and they would say that should be a very personal foul, and that was how they thought that was the only way that people would show up to watch women play sports, as if there was some sort of sexual innuendo to it. The most popular team, the best team and most popular team in women's basketball in the early 1970s was at Immaculata College, a small Catholic school near Philadelphia. There's been a movie made about them called Mighty Max. And they had a coach who, sort of by conventional standards was considered, a beautiful woman. She was married to an NBA official. She had kids. She talked often about how much she liked to wear nice clothes and wear expensive perfume at her games, and that she did not like women, she said, who dressed like men, you know, or only wore sweatsuits and did not project a sort of conventional femininity. And so you even had women who were sort of buying in to what was expected by men in sports. And so I write about that dynamic in the book also. There were a few women on the Olympic team in 76 who eventually came out as gay, but were not out at the time of the 76 Olympics. And so sexuality was not an issue that was publicly written about or raised in regards to players on that team at the time. But later, several members of the team did come out. And so it's a part of the history of that team. You know, I just think that overall, the point I wanted to make in the book is that sports is for everyone, you know, at least ideally, it should be, you know, and that every person should be free to pursue what they're passionate about, you know, and you shouldn't have to fit into a certain mold because you happen to be a woman. You know, if you want to play sports in the time of the 70s, it was considered, you know, against the grain. I don't think it is now. And I think this team played a big role in changing that perception. And you could say that lesbian women, LGBTQ women, played a role in changing the country in that way, you know, and making it more acceptable for you to pursue those dreams if that's what you would like to do.
I really appreciate how you pulled together so many intersections and identities in a story that could be very much just about sports. Mm-hmm. How much pushback do you get from people about making this so political, right? Because you're addressing race, gender, sexuality, historical, systematic discrimination. And, you know, I'm around sports fans who are just like, I just want to watch the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. And I work in college athletics as my day job. So I'm around people who feel that way too, you know, and I know that a lot of fans express that. I just think at this moment in time, this moment in American history, to not talk about those political issues would be, just sort of a dereliction of duty on my part as an author. You know, the whole reason I want to write these books is to introduce those topics. And I think sports is a really interesting platform to do that. It's for a couple of reasons. One, sports is supposed to be a level playing field. You know, at least you're told it is, right? There's rules of the game and everyone comes into this setting and it doesn't matter like how you got there. You know, it's just based on how do you perform in that game. But we see over and over again that the playing field isn't fair. It's not level, you know, for various reasons related to race and gender and sexuality, like you said. The other thing is I think that sports is very accessible. So it's maybe not intimidating to pick up a book with a basketball player on the cover, you know, or a baseball player on the cover and to read a biography or a book about a team or a player, but then get into a story that deals with racism or homophobia or anti-Semitism or sexism when you might not be a person that would intentionally pick up a book on one of those topics in the first place. Second thing is I think that you're kind of hinting at this in your question. I mean, there's so many efforts to ban books right now that deal with these subjects, which is a really scary thing. It's going to be to the detriment of kids and democracy in our country. And so, you know, if there's that much attention being paid to preventing people from reading these stories, it's all the more important to write them, you know? And so that's the way I feel.
Right. We just did an episode on the Little Rock Nine. And, mm-hmm. you know, like you mentioned with book banning and these lists that continue to grow and authors who find themselves unexpectedly on that list, mm-hmm. How young readers are just going to lack the context for our current situations and circumstances. So I really appreciate that. And it's amazing to see what is available for young readers and how that continues to grow. It's so much more that the topics go deep.
Yes,
and
they do.
I think we think highly of our young adults.
Oh gosh, I think extremely highly of young adults. And I don't think it's any coincidence that the bands are coming at a time when there has been more diversity in terms of the authors of books for young readers and the subject matter of books for young readers, you know, and trying to silence those voices either through an outright ban or a chilling effect. You know, so my book on the gay baseball player, Glenn Burke, to my knowledge, it hasn't been on a list, but I also know I haven't been invited to any schools to talk about it, you know? And so I think that's an especially scary aspect to this, is what we don't even know is happening, you know, and what students are not going to be learning because of a fear of someone showing up to fire or harm a librarian or a teacher, you know, or what might happen at a school board meeting. In some ways, you know, you can't blame a teacher or a librarian for just playing it safe. Which author are we going to bring in? Maybe not the one that's going to have this crazy crowd outside trying to burn the school down, you know?
Right.
But that's going to be a loss, like you say, for generations and then, you know, for our country in the future.
So I definitely don't want you to get out of here without, there's so many intersections, as Kathy said. Later in one of the chapters, you mention in the 1970s, you talk about right around 1976 being the bicentennial, and there was a lot of things in the air coming on the heels of Vietnam, and you have a mention there of Phyllis Schlafly, I think is how you say it. Mm-hmm. And one of our favorite books here on the show in the last couple of years is a book called Jesus and John Wayne. It talks about evangelical culture.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly current in the last calendar year still. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic of what the rise of the moral majority, the religious right, has to do with this 1976 team?
Sure. That's a really fascinating question. I live here in Williamson County outside of Nashville, which probably has more evangelical churches than any county in the country, which I do not go to. But there, you know, I thought it was really important in the book, like I said, to put it in the context of the times. And so this was a time when women were fighting for the Equal Rights Amendment, and it looked like it was going to pass. You know, I mean, it did pass through Congress and just needed to be ratified by the states. But Phyllis Schlafly came along and sort of represented what is still with us today, what, you know, really sort of flourished under the Reagan administration. But in terms of this sort of conservative moral majority movement, Schlafly was saying, you know, the last thing we need is an Equal Rights Amendment. Women in this country have it better than any women in the history of the world, thanks to things like frozen food, you know, and supermarkets and appliances, you know, which is kind of a ridiculous thing to say, but she was, in her mind, sort of defending traditional things like motherhood and marriage and family, without acknowledging really that that wasn't the case for a lot of people, and that there were women who had dreams beyond, as Betty Friedan would say, beyond baking a potato, you know, and existing really only in definition to how relation to men, like you were a mother or you were a wife or you were a girlfriend or you were a sex object, and only being defined against men. And so I thought that the athletes of this generation were also showing a different way to be a woman in America in the 1970s, you know, at the same time that these are the messages that are being battled about in society. And what was interesting to me was that at the time in the 1970s, there wasn't really a connection other than Billie Jean King, who you mentioned, between the leading feminists and the leading athletes of the era. They really operated in separate planes, where today, you might point to members of the U.S. women's national soccer team and say that they have been some of the most outspoken women on issues related to women's rights, especially like pay equity, you know, in the lawsuit that they had, and the platform that WNBA players used that affected a Senate race, you know, in the state of Georgia. Very different now in terms of, I think it's all.
Is that the Stacey Abrams seat or something else?
Yeah, no, it was Warnock.
Raphael Warnock.
Okay. Yeah. So they started supporting him against Kelly Loeffler when he was like in single digits in the polls, you know, and they really turned things around in that state, and he ends up winning. They were wearing Vote Warnock shirts, you know, at games. And so now, because of social media, I think women athletes have a large platform. They're using it, you know, to advocate for social issues. At the time in the 1970s, there really was no platform at all. And their way of making a point was simply by playing, you know, right. when everyone was telling them they shouldn't.
Right. Gosh, frozen food, the downfall of humanity. I'm just stunned.
Here you go.
So, Andrew, we're about out of time, but I wondered if, you know, you mentioned earlier we're at the 50th anniversary of Title IX. And shockingly, we have not fixed misogyny in sports or in culture yet. So maybe by way of, even with all that frozen food, it's still around. So maybe just by way of wrapping us up, could you tell us a little bit about maybe some of your dream for what the next generation could look like in terms of sports and culture for women of all shapes and sizes and sexualities?
Yeah, great question. So I think as the 50th anniversary is being celebrated, and there have been incredible accomplishments, and you shouldn't deny that things have changed significantly, there is still like unfinished business. And I think that's the story of Title IX. So looking to the future, I think what you'd like to see is really less of a distinction in how we think about sports, you know, not defining it as men's sports or women's sports, but it's just sports, you know, and admiring the talent of the athletes that are out there and providing equitable opportunities for anybody to compete and to play, you know, whether you're a world-class athlete and like you're in the Olympics or you're just a second grader, you know, that wants to have equal opportunities in elementary school. I mean, that's what we should be after. I think the things that people will notice that will change the most is media coverage of women's sports. You know, there had been this perception that people just weren't interested and they wouldn't watch. And that's been proven not to be true. So the Women's Softball College World Series had higher ratings than the Men's Baseball College World Series last year. WNBA has its highest ratings ever this past year. In the Tokyo Olympics, NBC showed more women's sports in primetime than men's sports for the first time in history. You know, and so you're starting to see evidence that if given an equal platform, people will gravitate towards women's sports at least in equal numbers, if not more. And so I think that's the biggest tangible difference that people are going to see in the future.
Such a fascinating conversation. Andrew, you know, book readers, the older they get, they say, I'm never going to get to read all the books I want. And how much harder for authors who want to write all those books. So I'm sure you've got some things marinating on your mind. What are you turning your attention to next?
Yeah, so I'm starting a series of books for even younger readers. So these books that we've been talking about, I would say would be for, you know, middle school, high school, college, adults. I'm going to start a series for maybe first graders. And I say maybe, I'm not quite sure like what the sweet spot is going to be, but I've written the first book. And it's a series of at least four books called Bigger Than Sports about athletes who have done some good for other people off the field or off the court. And so the first book is about Maya Moore, who is a college basketball star at UConn, best player in the country, national championships there. And then in the WNBA, she was an MVP multiple times and won many championships. And she quit playing professional basketball at the height of her career to help get a man out of prison that was in prison for a crime that he did not commit. Mm-hmm. The second book will be about LeBron James and the work he's done in Akron to start a school for kids in the neighborhood where he grew up. Then I'm looking for other stories of athletes who did more than just write a check, you know, or attach their name to an event, you know, but really dedicate a part of their life to making a world a better place. And I think those are values that I'd like to, you know, get across to kids at an even younger age. I don't think it's ever too young, you know, as a parent to start sharing those types of stories. And again, I think kids, as much as anybody, can gravitate towards a book about sports. That's going to get their interest. And then hopefully they just realize that they love reading and they get into all sorts of books after that.
Awesome stuff. Well, hopefully people dive into those and don't think that, you know, loving your neighbor is something we should ban, because it sounds like some great, great ideas there.
Yeah, thank you. I hope not.
You
so
never
where can
know.
People find? Yeah. You don't. All right. Where can people find you, Andrew?
Okay. You can find me on my website. It's probably the first place to go, which is just my name, andrewmarinus.com. I'm on Twitter quite a bit, and my handle is trueblue24, TRUBLU24, which is a nod to the True Blue Brew Crew, the Milwaukee Brewers, my favorite baseball team. And then on Instagram,
we'll hold that against you.
What are you guys fans of?
Cubs.
Cubs. All right.
I'm from Pittsburgh. I grew up in so Kansas City. Okay.
Yeah. Pirates and Royals and Cubs and Brewers. What a motley collection.
When you grew up as a Royals fan in the 80s and 90s, you just had to love baseball. You weren't going to watch your team win.
No. Well, same with Milwaukee and Pittsburgh. And, I mean,
and Kathy, the Cubs.
Imagine being a Cubs fan in the conversation and you have the most successful team. How often does that happen?
Yeah. You have to pretty much read a book about Clemente in order to find anything to celebrate for the Pirates. So
there you go. One of my dad's books. So, and then I was going to say Instagram is my first initial A in Marinus, A Marinus on Instagram. But, and I should say also this inaugural Ballers book exists as a book, which I still like to read, or like a hard copy book, but there's an ebook and an audio version book of it also.
Love it. Well, Andrew, awesome. Thank you so much. This has been a great interview. I really appreciate the book. And good luck with your future projects.
Thank you so much. You guys lived up to the name. This has been a fascinating podcast for me too. Appreciate it.
Great. Awesome. Thank
you. Have a great one, Andrew. Thanks so much.
You too. Take care. Thank you.
Okay, before we go, we've got to hear about what's fascinating us. So, Clay, I know that you had something really timely.
Well, yeah, I mean, we alluded to it during the interview, but I've been reading David Marinus for years, and he's written a lot of famous biographies. We mentioned the Clinton biography, the Clemente biography. He's written a number of books. His latest book that just came out in recent weeks is Path Lit by Lightning. And I didn't plan this to speak with Andrew today, but the Path Lit by Lightning book is about Jim Thorpe. And so, as the entire Marinus family does, it's a great story about sports and history. And we talk on the episode about those boarding schools, the Christianization of Native Americans in that era, and all the exploitation that followed. So, if you don't know about Jim Thorpe, he was arguably the greatest athlete of the 20th century. He's certainly in the conversation. And he famously won gold medals in the Stockholm Olympics in the 1910s and was then stripped of those medals for a whole bunch of garbage. The IOC recently reinstated him. But you can learn about that story and read a wonderful book like I am called Path Lit by Lightning, which is actually Jim Thorpe's native name.
Love it. Kathy, what do you have?
I'm actually watching House of the Dragon on HBO and finding it really actually interesting, a little less bloody and naked, except for like an episode here and there. That seems to be the show that the three of us who are home right now are enjoying, House of the Dragon. And how about you, JR?
I've been watching House of the Dragon as well, and it's fine.
Yeah.
I keep watching it.
Yeah, the recent episode, right? They did a big... it's interesting how they're kind of doing time jumps now. And
Time jump. Yeah.
I don't know. There's some interesting things there.
Yeah, maybe other shows are doing the time jump thing better, maybe?
Speaking of which, Kathy, I am just obsessed with the new Quantum Leap.
Quantum Leap is my pick. Quantum Leap is my pick. I picked Quantum Leap this week.
Clay and I both have a deep and unending love for the original Quantum Leap series, which ran from 89 to 93. And this is a sequel reboot. It is set in the same universe. The original project was shuttered, and new scientists are trying to figure out what happened. And then one of them makes an unauthorized leap, and now he's stuck in time with amnesia. So, yep. He is having to leap around, putting right what once went wrong, and hoping each time that his next leap will be the leap home.
I believe Swiss cheese memory is the canonical way to say amnesia.
They did not say that in the
pilot.
They did not.
So we finally got to watch it last night, and I was really fascinated because, you know, Jen was just like, meh, I guess I'll watch this with you. And I'm like, what is wrong with you as a human?
So before you say that, I did the appropriate thing and had my wife watch Quantum Leap leading up to. So she was appropriately motivated and excited.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the Bible would have you do, I'm sure. So
anyway, what did you think?
All I'll say is this: it was really like, I know the beats of the general show, and I'm waiting to see how they're going to change. So, of course, what happens is he leaps into other people, and like, I'm waiting for him to look in the mirror for the first time, and he's about to, and Jen's not looking at the screen, and I pause it. I'm like, hey, the big reveal! Like, this is what we do here. And she looked up and saw it. She's like, oh, so he like sees different people. He's like different people. I was like, we have so much work to do.
You really
but
do.
But because she knew so little, it was actually a fun discovery for her. And she definitely is in for another episode. So
nice. Which premiere, which is already out, which as
came,
soon as
it
we're
was
done
on
here,
last night. Yeah.
Yeah. Last night is the time we're recording. So anyway, Quantum Leap reboot. It's terrific. Interested to see how Jen likes it as someone who was not a fan of the original show. Kathy, do you care about this at all?
No, not.
Okay.
I don't think I watched the original show, but because of the lead of the new show, I do feel compelled to watch at least a little bit to support.
When you say the lead, you mean the lead actor of the new Quantum Leap, who's played.
Yes.
So the character now is Ben Song, by the way, and it's Raymond Lee is playing him. So I am really interested in some of the things they've done to mix it up. So we're not going to give any spoilers, but all of the beats are the same, but they've definitely changed the way they're going to tell stories by some very significant decisions. So very good. Check it out.
All right, friends. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Fascinating Podcast. We will, of course, be back next week where we are going to be talking about woke media. So looking forward to that conversation, probably lots of us raging and some other things. So
is this like revisionist history where we used to be three white guys, but now we recast Matt with a Korean woman?
Yep, exactly. Yep. Yeah. Have you ever seen Matt and Kathy in a room at the same time? No. And
no.
Conveniently they're writing a book together.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Right.
We see what's happening here.
Surely.
Just another woke rewrite this podcast.
Yeah. When we said Matt's sick, what we meant is Kathy's voice changer is out of batteries. So.
Good times.
All right, folks. Again, thanks so much for listening and sharing. We will be back next week. Until then, take care of each other, take care of yourselves, and be well.